listening to Truth2 Radio with Jono on truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. Also available on iTunes. And g'day to Adrian in Pennsylvania. Also Rachel, who shared Light of the Prophets on Facebook. Thank you guys for sharing, and please continue to share it. And wherever you may be around the world, it's good to have your company. Of course, it is time for Light of the Prophets with Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, Yoel.
G'day, too. First of all, ladies and gentlemen, a round of applause. This is the first time in a while that he does the introduction without stuttering.
Do you like that?
Wow. I was sitting there like...
I've been practicing.
He's actually got it this time.
Hey, that's
By
all everyone.
George,
that's because
he's got it.
I edit those bits out. As far as they know, I get it perfect every single time. Hey, we got some comments. I'm going to read these comments.
Out.
These are good comments. This is from Derek. Okay. Derek says, thanks for the shout out.
Derek,
thanks, Yoel and Jono, for taking time out of your schedule and making these teachings available. I know Yoel is very busy, and we really appreciate the time and effort you put into this. You are really busy. Not only are you juggling a whole lot of students, but you're also packing to move, right?
Yes, we're moving out into the desert.
Out into the desert.
No, you should. I'm going to take pictures of the view from the house. I mean, it's actually an apartment. It's very difficult. There's a whole housing issue here in Israel. So we're moving again to a small apartment. I mean, I wish I could something with at least one more room. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about very small apartments. But the view is amazing, and there's open space all over around us, you know. So it's not the end of the world. You know, if I feel crowded in the house, just walk out the house and...
And
I'm in the desert, you know, and it's amazing view, and there's animals, and there's wildlife in the area as well. It's illegal to hunt, but, you know, it's still kind of cool, you know, a family of deer run by the, not exactly deer, but run by the house and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. About like a mile away from the village we're moving into, there's plantation with plants, mm-hmm. and then it suddenly becomes a desert. It's kind of interesting. It's pretty amazing that everywhere we go, suddenly plants grow. So even if it's really, you know, shallow plants, very low plants, you know, something that's very more for grazing, it's still pretty amazing that you walk around here in Israel, a place which was completely desert-like 100 years ago, and now it's green.
Mm.
You know, I remember looking at pictures from the area of Jerusalem back from the 1800s. It was a British company that sent a couple guys with a plane to take pictures of the Holy Land from above.
Yes.
And you can see the old city, and there's nothing around it, and it's all desert.
Mm.
And now we're here, and everything goes green.
Everything is green.
Pretty amazing.
And you know, that's credit to Israel's the infrastructure that they have and the policies that they have in regards to the use of water as well. Which really is very, very efficient, because you guys don't get a lot of water, right?
We're actually, it's very interesting. This area is divided up. There's a line. There's an interesting water line where north of here and south of here are water lines of, I can't remember the degrees exactly, but it's a water line where they get very, very little rain. And we're smack in the middle on the lower half. But for example, Syria and Turkey get a lot of rain. We're actually quite lucky. We're really on the border. We get rain, and it can be sufficient amount of rain. But what's been happening is a climate. There's a climate shift. Every 30 years, there's a climate shift in this area where it drops, the quantity of rain drops, and then it goes up. For example, this year, the amount of rain was immense. I mean, we're talking, I have not seen a winter like this in something like 10 years.
Really? Nice.
We actually had, you know, it went really cold, and it rained, and it rained so much that water started getting into the walls. We had a fungi here in the house we had to take care of. It was because, wow. And everyone in the building had it. Because of the fungi.
And the humidity had increased.
The humidity. Wow, so when it became hot just before Chag HaMatzot, we actually had to take bleach, pure bleach, get the kids out of the house, move everything away from the walls, and bleach the walls because this thing wouldn't die without bleach.
Wow.
And the house stank of bleach for like 2 days.
Yay.
And, we had to keep the windows open the whole time and the fans going just to air up the house so you can actually breathe the air.
Wow.
So thank God it was really rainy. But what happened was like 3-4 years ago, they started a campaign of we don't have water.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, we have a ton of water here. It's in the aquifer. But the problem is that there's a huge aquifer in Samaria.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very good reason why not to give up on Samaria, because there's a massive aquifer there, bigger than the Kinneret. And there's one in the Negev, like something like 3 or 4 times bigger than the Kinneret.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all drinkable water. So there's no reason to get rid of these areas. You know, so people say, oh, Samaria. We don't need Samaria. Yeah. The moment you don't have those mountains, you do not have access to that water. You don't have also access to the water coming down from the mountains into the rivers and into the other valleys. So don't be stupid. If you do that, they'll find a way to block the water and they'll just dry us out. Okay. And there's a struggle. Water is very important in this area. For example, in the Gaza Strip, they're blaming us for it. But what's happened is that they overpumped. They overpumped the water in Gaza. Gaza had plenty of water, and they don't know what they're doing. The system in the Gaza Strip, they have no idea what they're doing.
It certainly seems like water management there is not as efficient as water management in Israel. I think we can safely say that.
It's more than that. There's no real government there. There's no municipality. There's nothing. There's a bunch of people who seize power with murder and deceit, and they want to be in power. There's no reason for them to be there. Hamas is like the worst thing ever to happen to the people living in the Gaza Strip.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like the worst thing. It would be better off for them to us to take charge there like it used to be.
Well, they were. It was better off.
It was.
It's clear.
They were better. When people talk about the flourishing economy of the Gaza Strip, what are you talking about?
Oh, dear me. But, I mean, there's been last few days, last week, there's been rockets and rockets and rockets.
Yeah, and the international news is ignoring it. And Hamas is talking as if we started it. Every time they start it, we slap them silly, and they start going, it's your fault. It's like a bunch of children. No one really knows what's going on here. No one really understands. The 80% of the Arabs, for example, living in Jerusalem, when they were asked, would you be willing to live under the Palestinian Authority? And 80% said, no.
No. Yeah, so that's smart.
So that's my ranting about the Arabs for this week.
We better move on.
And you should understand something. Again, I have nothing against them. You should know there's a lot of Arabs I worked with, and they admit full heartedly they prefer to be citizens of the State of Israel, and they prefer to work with the little Satan than to be involved with these people.
But it's an ongoing concern.
You should hear what some of these guys told me. You should hear what some of these guys told me.
Mm-hmm. And
it's
that,
horrendous.
Of course,
with
what is happening in Egypt, of course, and the Muslim Brotherhood's been now.
Oh, they want confirmed. To become friends with Iran.
Anyway, we better keep going. Janice, Janice said, commented saying, great schmoozing episode. There was so much info, and I will have to listen to it a couple times more. Thank you again for all the time and effort that you both put into these teachings. And Catherine, remember you answered some of Catherine's questions, and she said, Shalom, Jono, and Yoel. Thank you, brothers, for your comments on my question from last week. Greatly appreciate your wisdom.
It was a question about prayer, right?
Yeah, it was, in regards
to
the
10 minutes, well.
So on and so forth. She said, best radio station ever. Love that.
I like that. I can now walk around with pride that I'm on the...
You're on the best radio station.
Okay, best station radio. So I can say it's wonderful to be on the best station radio, radio station ever.
You can tell all your friends that. What do you do?
I'm on a radio station, the best one in the world.
In the world. That's your claim to fame. Today we are kicking off from Judges chapter 6. And look, now we've gotten... Now this is... We've done Otniel, we've done Ehud, we've done Shamgar. Let's not forget him. And, of course, Deborah. Now, number 5 is we're coming up to Gideon, but we're going to kick off from verse 6, and it begins like this. Then the children of Israel...
Wait. Before we start the story, there's going to be a lot of breaks here. I'm going to stop you a lot of times because there's something very, very important about the character of Gideon here. There's several very important things that we have to understand. First of all, Derek sent me a question about chapter 8. Actually, I'm sorry, I forgot what the question was. I don't remember, and I don't have the original message. So sorry. But what's very interesting here is this is the first story that actually covers more than one chapter, and there's character development here. There's a lot of information about the main character. There's a lot of information on what's going on here. There's a lot of details, and there's a new concept. A concept that's vital for the understanding. I don't know vital, but something which is basically a main motif inside the stories of the book of Judges. So we're going to focus on a whole bunch of stuff, and we're going to say, okay, this verse is very important because X, Y, Z. So there's going to be a lot of stops here. I actually spent a lot of time studying this story because this is really where we start dealing with a lot of information. And there's a lot of details that come out from the story, and I even had a discussion with one of my students last night, and I told her I did a study on Gideon, and she said, so what do you think of this? And we pulled out the more or less the same ideas, but there's a few other things I've pulled out. But we have to realize that also what's very important is going on here. We have one of the worst cases, because up to now, it was a threat. They caused trouble. They didn't really attack. Here we have something completely different going on. First of all, it's only seven years. It's not as if they were under for 20 years, 18 years. It's only 7 years, but the amount of damage the Midianites created was so big.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the most violent we bump into up to now. You know, they were threatening a war here. They were causing damage left, right, and center on a scale that we haven't seen up to now.
Mm.
Okay, up to now we had stories. Oh, they caused trouble. They enslaved them. They threatened war. Whatever it is here, it's like vandalism. Here, it's like violent vandalism. You know, attacking things for no real reason. But also realize the fact that the Midianites, very similar to Koshan Rish Atayim, are not really dwellers in this area. The Midianites, when you go towards Arabia, Koshan Rish Atayim was in Aram, which is north. It's more like the area of Turkey. But this is like the worst we have to now. Now you can start reading.
Well, this is what it says. Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and so the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years, and the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel because of the Midianites. Look at this. The children of Israel made for themselves the dens, the caves, and the strongholds which are in the mountains. Are they still there? Are there...
So again, minharot, for the word here. So first it says, vata'oz yad Midian. So the word here is oz, which is real power. It's like might. So they really prevailed over Israel in a really, really massive way. And they created, I don't know of any, strongholds caves in the mountains. Or... I mean, you have, for example, Mount Arbel, there's a stronghold there, but I'm not too sure when it's from.
Mm.
But we're talking about, for example, if you go to Mount Carmel, there's a lot of these types of places, a lot of caves up there. There are a lot of, creeks and places. So Minharot, for example, are actually more like, from the word Nahar, I looked at a commentary, said it's more like the word Nahar, which means a river. So these are creeks. They basically went into places, dry creeks, and basically found places to hide in there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for example, if you go to the Creek of Prat, which I've been there quite a few times, and it's a beautiful place. I mean, you can actually go in, and it gets narrower and narrower, and you can actually hide there.
Mm-hmm.
You have a supply of water in that area as well.
And so they're so oppressed that they're like scared animals hiding in the rocks, in the caves, in the in the mountains, and so on and so forth. And verse 3, so it was whenever Israel had sown, Midianites would come up, also Amalekites, and the people of the east would come up against them. Then they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza, and leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep nor ox nor donkey. But they would come up with their livestock, with their tents, coming in as numerous as locusts. I've got Yoel and both.
Yeah, that's classic. In the ancient world, we have this in the book of Yoel as well. And I actually found it in the Assyrian and Babylonian scriptures. When they want to talk about hordes of something, locust. It's always locust. Everything is defined as locust. Massive quantities of people, locust.
Locust. And they and their camels were without number. And they would enter the land and destroy it. So Israel was greatly impoverished because the Midianites and the children of Israel cried out to Jehovah. And it came to pass when the children of Israel cried out to Jehovah because of the Midianites, that Jehovah sent a prophet to the children of Israel, who said to them, now we don't know where the prophet is, right? We don't know who he is.
Yeah,
we don't
have his name, but it's very interesting that this prophet speaks very similar to what we had in Bochim in chapter 1 or 2. We had another man of God that went to Bochim and spoke with them. And he says very similar words as well.
Yep. Thus says Jehovah, God of Israel, I brought you up out of Egypt and brought you up out of the house of bondage. I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of those who oppressed you. And I drove them out before you and gave you their land. Also, I said to you, I am Jehovah your God. Do not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, but you have not obeyed my voice. Now, here we go with Gideon. Now, the angel... or the messenger. Is this the same person that we're reading about in the previous verses?
I'm not too sure, because this is a prophet. This is it says here, Veishlach Adonai Ish Navi. So it's a man who is a prophet. Here it says, Vayavom Malach Adonai, uses the actual name. Malach, so Malach usually means a messenger.
Mm.
Here it's actually an actual, probably what we call an angel.
Sure. So the messenger of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth tree, which was in Ophrah. which belonged to Yoash, the
Aviezrite. So it's the family of Aviezer. They were actually a very famous family. There was a region when they were okay. It was like this. There's a place called Shomron, which was owned by a man called Shemer. Omri, the father of Achav, bought the mountain. He built the city of Shomron, named after Shemer, the king, the owner of the mountain. And in the place of Shomron, they found what's called the ostrichers of Shomron. So here it's Avi HaIzri, because it's trying to state something. It doesn't say Yoash of Avi. It's trying to say Yoash of the family of Avi Ezer. But there's a certain way the Bible is trying to say it. Instead of saying Yoash, because Avi Ezer, it goes like this. The name Avi Ezer is a compound name. It's Avi and Ezer, my father who's helped. Okay? Ezer is help. Avi is my father. The Bible, by the way, doesn't have the word Abba. Abba is the Aramaic equivalent of father. Mm-hmm. Abba and Ima, or Aramaic Hebrew, is Av and Im. Right. And Avi Ezer, so it breaks up, because Avi Ezer is really not one word, it's two words. It's trying to put the definite article, if I miss something. In Hebrew, there's basically two things which can function as the, but there's really only one. There's the word et. Mm-hmm. Which actually is never never really translated, but there was someone who came up, I think it was in the BDB, they came up with this whole idea of it has no real function, and they count this places where they don't understand why it's there. That's because of the lack of knowledge of biblical Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
But the word et always means, always necessary when we want to have something which is a direct object in a sentence. For example, Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. There's really in Hebrew two the in Hebrew. But in European languages, the word et, for example, doesn't really exist. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Ben-Gurion wanted to cancel the use of the word et because he tried to say, oh, there's no use for it. But it's completely wrong. It's very useful, and we have to have it in the language.
Mm.
But the way Hebrew creates a direct object uses the word et, and then in many cases it uses the definite article of hey. So here, what we have here is avi-ezer is really like a basically almost like in a construct chain. And Avi Ezer, so in the construct chain, what we do is we take the definite article and put it before the second word, okay? But here, because it's not exactly a pure form of a construct, say I can't really use all the definitions here. But basically, it breaks up the word. It's called Avi HaIzri, so basically the family of Avi Ezer. This is what it's trying actually to say. But it doesn't use the word et, so there's no the.
HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. We have to just let everybody know Hebrew lessons, although I think you're fully booked at the moment, but you can
At the moment, I'm fully booked.
But you can get on a waiting list, and it is HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com for Hebrew lessons. Now, his son, Gideon, threshed wheat in...
So, Gideon, I'm going to cut you off again. The word Gideon is another thing here. There's a whole discussion regarding his name. So first of all, Gideon Shimshon. It's very interesting, this whole, the way his name is the on ending is a very, very special ending. I'm actually, to tell the truth, I'm not 100% clear exactly what this ending means. But the root of his first part of his name, Gideon, Gimel Daled Ayin, is from the root of Gada, which is to cut something off, to cut something off, to break something off. Usually it's done with a weapon. So when someone's godea something, it's usually done with a weapon. And it's very, very interesting because his name also has a very, very interesting meaning here, because then afterwards he's given another name, but they all represent an issue of a person who has strength, a person who's powerful, which there's a whole discussion. There's actually someone who claims that this wasn't his real name, and the second name we obviously know is not his real name, and this was just a name. This was a nickname given to him after the war, and his original name was something else. We don't know what it is.
Interesting, and we're going to be getting to the second name soon. But he threshed wheat in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites, and the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, "The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor." Immediately, he's addressed him in this way.
Yeah, so he turns to him and he says to him, one of the most obvious things that we know of, he's calling him, "You're a man of valor." Hmm. He says to him in Hebrew, he says, "Vayomer elav Adonai imcha gibor hechayil." He turns around saying to him, "You know who you are." And also, by the way, the Adonai imcha is actually the classic greeting.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Boaz goes and says, he turns to the people in the film and says, Adonai imachem, and they turn back saying, Yevarcha Adonai. You know, it's basically, this is a classic greeting.
Sure.
So we can see some of the culture. So the people didn't say shalom. They actually turn around. It's very interesting. Nehemiah is about to produce this book about
shattering about the conspiracy of silence.
And mostly relate to the issue of the priestly blessing. And it's amazing. It's an amazing book. I've said this already, but it's an amazing book. And there's also Keith Johnson's book, His Hallowed Name Revealed Again.
Amen.
And there's an interesting entry in the last, in the Mishnah, Tractate of Brachot, which is the first set of Mishnayot in the Mishnah. And there's a section, I think it's the last Mishnah there, I think it's Mishnah 9, says, and they established that they will greet each other with the name.
Yes.
And what they did there is they turn around and actually said the actual name. There was no limitation how you on saying the name. They actually said the name. They pronounced Yud Hey and then Vav Hey as well. And that's how we usually do it. If you want to mention the letters, we just do a stop in between so we don't say the actual. There's a big argument. Are you even about to say the letters or is it only just saying with vowel points?
Sure.
Big mess. But anyhow, a big mess, and it's really, when you research it, you realize it's a lot of rubbish. There were actually rabbis. It's funny. There were rabbis who were completely against this idea.
Mm-hmm.
There were rabbis who were against this idea and insisted continuing using the name, but they were a minority.
Sure.
But basically, when you, for example, open up Maimonides, he writes, for example, Yud Hey, and then says Vav Hey. You know, he tells you this is how you read. You're allowed to say Yud Hey Vav Hey. Yes. Maimonides has no issue with that. He only says how it says there, Hoget Hashem Beotiotav, the one who pronounces the name with its letters. Hoge is to actually speak, and Hashem Beotiotav, meaning it's actually saying the name with vowel points.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so classic. You know, most Jews won't say Yud Hey Vav Hey. Me being, I'm a strong follower of Maimonides on many aspects. I mean, there was a time when I followed everything according to Maimonides. Mm-hmm. And I agree with his interpretation. Interpretation makes more sense based on how it's worded. But they actually would walk to each other. I wouldn't say shalom. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
When a person would meet someone in the street or see from distance, he wants to bless him. He would say, Yud Hey Vav Hey, bless you. Mm-hmm. That's how they did it. Or they say, Yud Hey Vav Hey, with you, meaning with everything you do. And a person would turn back and say to him, and you may Yud Hey Vav Hey bless you. He didn't say shalom.
No.
And
they would greet each other with the name. And so we see that the messenger of the Lord, the messenger of Jehovah, does so here in verse 12. And it's interesting because in verse 13, then we see Gideon using both Adonai and the name. Gideon said to him, "Oh Adonai, if Jehovah is with us, then
there's a problem. Your one says Adonai."
Actually, no, it doesn't. It has a little asterisk. It says, "Oh my Lord," in lowercase letters.
In Hebrew, it says, "Be Adoni." So first of all, "Be" Adoni. is almost a formula of oath. "Be Nishbati" is usually the formula we find in the Bible. So "Be" is basically saying, "Oh my," basically as if he's punching his chest and saying, "You know, what are you talking about?" You know, putting your hand to your chest or raising your hand is like a sign of oath. So here it's in language, it's "Be Adoni." Just, what are you talking about? You know, as I exist. Because people used to sometimes swear on their head or on themselves as something being true, not necessarily using God's name, but saying, "No, be in me, the fact that I exist, I take an oath in my life." This is really what he's saying. Mm. He's saying, "Be Adoni." He doesn't recognize him as being an angel yet. And there's a discussion. And there are commentators, modern commentators that want to say this has to actually be written as Adonai. But the use of the name Adonai in the book of Judges, as far as I remember, is very, very rare. So it would be very, very strange that it should be with the vowel points of Adonai, being with a kamatz at the end. Because if you write Adonai with a patach, it means my lords. And when you write it with a kamatz, it's another name of saying master. Now, it's in a plural, which is kind of weird, the whole discussion by itself. Actually, I think Nehemiah spoke about this. We ran into the word Elohim, so I don't have to expand on this.
Hmm.
But the text, the Masoretic text says Adoni. So he's referring to as a person. He doesn't, the angels and something, angels appeared as human beings. We have this as Abraham. We don't recognize them as human beings. So he turns around, he's very doubtful. His character up to a certain point is extremely doubtful about everything, and he's afraid of everything.
If nothing else, he's at least very, very cautious, right?
He's extremely cautious. He needs everything to be with signs. He needs to know. He needs confirmation on every step on the way. He's really afraid, and he needs some reassurance.
A lot
of reassurance. But the moment, there's one point where he clicks and he changes, and we'll see that point.
We will.
But regarding this specific word, it's in the text. It says Adoni, which means Adoni, sir.
If the Lord is with us, then why has all this happened to us? And where are all his miracles, which our fathers told us about, saying, did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt? But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites. Then so it
there's
says...
There's a rabbinic midrash. It doesn't really fit with the verses, but there's a rabbinic midrash that says that this was immediately after Leila Seder, and this is in the middle of Chag HaMatzot. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't work because he says he's chovet chitim. He's plowing wheat, so it doesn't work. He's probably way in somewhere towards Shavuot, maybe.
Oh, okay.
So somewhere during the summer. But there's a midrash that says that the reason he brought up this that we came to Egypt because he just did Passover with his family, mm-hmm. and he turns around to angels and said, we just last night, two nights ago, we sat down, we spoke about Passover and leaving Egypt, and now you're telling me this. What are you talking about?
That's valid. That's fair enough.
I don't think it's valid because he's dealing with wheat, so this is later on. But maybe it could be a matter of a few weeks after Shavuot. Yeah, maybe it's just immediately after Shavuot or something. Yeah. So the memory is still there because if you remember,
it's fresh.
Sukkot has 7 days and then an eighth day. So one of the things I don't think we ever spoke about this thing about when we recorded about Shavuot, but one of the things about Shavuot itself is that it's as if like it's the eighth day of Pesach, like Sukkot has an eighth day. Pesach or Chag HaMatzot has an eighth day as well, but it has to be 50 days later because there's a relationship here with the barley and the wheat. So it's postponed 50 days later. That's one of the interpretations I saw, and I forgot to mention it when we did the recording about Shavuot.
Fair enough. And then an interesting thing happens, because we're talking about the angel of the Lord, but then in verse 14 it says, then the Lord turned to him and said, go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you? And so he said to him, and again he says...
So there's something very... I'm sorry I'm cutting you off. There's a lot of details here.
Mm.
I don't know if I mentioned this before. I mentioned it again just to emphasize it. There's this role of messengers. Yes. When you send a messenger, that messenger speaks in the name of the person who sent him or whoever sent him, and therefore he can actually say... when he speaks to him as if directly that the sender is speaking.
Speaking in the authority of the sender, yeah.
Exactly. And this is why it's not unusual for an angel to turn around and speak in the name of God as if God himself is speaking to the person. And this is why now, up to now, he disappears as an angel or nothing, but now he's giving the message of God. So now he's speaking in the name of God.
He's speaking
and
in the name of God.
And therefore, this is why we can have the switch from an angel to the actual
name. Words. Yeah. And yet we know that he's still speaking with the angel because in verse 15 he says to him, mm-hmm. Oh, my Lord, this Adonai, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh and I am the least in my father's house.
And he's not. And that's the thing. He's not. His father's very important. They have a big farm. They're very influential. He's just trying to avoid it. And look at it kind of very similar to Moses, by the way.
Mm.
It's kind of Moses was very afraid to do things as well.
Mm.
And he was saying, I'm too afraid, don't send me, I'm too weak, I stutter, blah, blah, blah. Mm. And what's very important about the character of Gideon, he's the first character that we see people actually want to turn him into a king.
Yeah, that's interesting. We will get to that.
And Gideon also is a miniature prophet because he gets an angel speaking to him directly, and he asks for things and miracles happen.
Mm-hmm.
And he's basically, there's an imitation here of the character of Moses as well.
That's interesting.
To a certain degree. Not insane, to a certain degree. But what's very, very interesting, he turns here and he says Adonai. Now it says, instead of saying Yud Hei Vav Hei, it's actually saying Aleph Daled Nun Yud. Why is he doing this? Because he's recognized, okay, he's speaking in the name of God, but he's not directly God. So he's not going to use the actual name of God. He's going to use what we call, what Maimonides calls in the Guide of the Perplexed. He says that the name Adonai is an imagery of the name of God and not literally the name of God. Mm-hmm. And this is why, for example, in Isaiah 6, it says, and I saw Adonai. It doesn't actually say the name. Why? Mm-hmm. Because he's not really seeing God himself. He's seeing an angel that's a representative of God, and therefore he can't really use the name of God.
So
because it says in the Torah, Lo yireni Adam v'chai, no man can see me and live.
True. And then it goes on, and again, Yehovah is speaking in the first person. It says, surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat the Midianites as one man. As one man?
As one man. So as one man, basically, it means you're going to come in an army as if there's one man really against you. This is usually what they say. I mean, some people say Ki Ish Echad is referring to Gideon's army, and some people say Ki Ish Echad is referring to the Midianites. And here we bump into something that's kind of funny.
I suppose both could be true, hey?
Both could be true. I mean, there is such a thing in the Bible that a word can be pulled to both ways, you know, to here and here. It's actually quite common, specifically in poetry. We can have a word settled somewhere, and it's actually related to what's before it and after it. So it's quite normal. But what we have here is now he starts like this whole thing. I want a sign. I want confirmation. Mm. And he does this several times.
So did Moses, right?
So yeah, it's very similar again to the character of Moses. There's this element of fear, and you know, Moses always turns around and says to God, you know, why have you made it worse for these people? You know, they haven't left Egypt, now they're suffering even more. What are you doing? So here it's more like on the personal level, he basically says, I want a sign that you're really talking to me.
Mm.
So God basically the angel says, okay, I'll give you a sign. And it's kind of interesting what he says to him. He's playing this very cautious game here. So this is why I'm taking over for a moment. Because what he says here, he says to him, don't leave until I return to you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm translating out the Hebrew. And I'll bring out to you minchati. Now a mincha, I don't know if people remember this. I actually posted this on Facebook. There's a difference between mincha and mas'et. A mincha is when, he's not saying the word korban. He's saying a mincha. This is an angel. He's not going to give him a sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
But he's playing a game here where this mincha is actually kind of like a sacrifice. So he says to him, I'll bring out this mincha, which is an offering. Mincha is usually a word that means you take from the lower person, giving to the higher person. And a mas'et is the other way around. Mas'et is a gift from the higher person to the lower person.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets a goat, and he cooks the goat and everything, and he brings loaves of bread. I think he actually brings unleavened bread. Yeah, matzot, it says, but ve'fat kemach matzot, he brings an eifah, which is actually a very large quantity. It's kind of interesting. He brings a big quantity of bread, a goat, cooked goat, and the liquid from the cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually imitates a sacrifice. He brings it to him, and he wants to give it to him. And what does he say? He puts the bread in a basket, and the soup, the liquids, basically the gravy, he puts inside some kind of cauldron or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he brings it to him under the Allah, under a tree, and he gives it to him. Vayagesh. He wants to serve it to him to eat. You know, I want you to eat with me, or whatever it is.
Hmm.
There's a whole issue of eating together, and that becomes some kind of a covenant.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Is he kind of sealing the deal? Like, okay, you say this
yeah,
is going to
happen, like saying, okay,
stick it down and let's seal it with a meal, right?
Exactly, let's seal it with a meal.
Mm.
So what happens is, so he's bringing the food, and the angel says to him, the angel of God says to him, take the meat and the bread and put them on this rock. Now, I have to remember, rocks can also be altars.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite common. If you have a large enough rock with a slightly flat surface, it can be an altar.
Sure.
And the soup or the liquid pour over, and he did that.
Yes.
Now you look at the meat; it's like sacrificial meat. You look at the bread; it's like a grain offering.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at the liquid; it's like the liquid offering.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like he's basically he's juggling. If this is really a man, if this is just a man who's just going to eat, and is a man of God, and I've given him a gift.
Mm-hmm.
But if this is really an angel, this can also function as a sacrifice. So he's still being very, very cautious. He says, I want to see if this is really what I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then the angel of God pulled out the edge of his staff, which is in his hand. He touched the meat and the bread, and a fire came out from the flint and consumed the meat and the bread, and the angel of God vanished from his eyes. Now here's what's happening. He turns around, and Gideon saw that this was an angel of God.
Mm.
And Gideon said, aha, ah, you know, he's yelling out like, oh no, because
yes.
it's a aha. There's, for example, places where it says, aha leyon, you know, it's a yelling out of fear. And now he says, Adonai, and we have the whole issue of the vowel points on this one, because we really usually use Adonai Elohim, but we have the name of God with the vowel points of the word Elohim. There's a big discussion. There's a whole discussion. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what the Masoretes were trying to do here. For I have seen the angel of God. The angel of God face to face. So there was a belief in the ancient world that if you have contact with any of the celestial beings, you know, any of the spiritual beings, you can actually die from it. And we have this again with other characters as well. And then a voice comes up from the heaven and says to him, and God said to him, peace to you, do not fear, you will not die. So what does Gideon do? So first of all, now he knows this was really a messenger of God speaking to him, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
So he also he's got his sign, he's got his reassurance. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is he builds an altar, and there's this classic thing. You build an altar and you give it a name. What's the name he gives this altar? Shalom. Peace.
Shalom.
Shalom.
The Lord is peace. And, I've got a question though, because this is a really controversial verse, right?
I don't know if it's been controversial. Enlighten me.
Okay, but okay, so how is it that Gideon can make build an altar? I mean, didn't we read in Joshua the trouble that the tribes on the other side of the Jordan almost got themselves into when they built an altar, which they weren't intending to use, but they built it as a memorial, as a witness? And in light of, you know, Deuteronomy 16, that there shall not be any altars, any offering outside of the place that he chooses to put his name. But here we see Gideon building an altar. How do we put that together?
It's a good question. Unless, you know, because he's a messenger of God, I really don't know. This is a very good question.
When God says the place that I choose to put my name, is it possible that because he's chosen Gideon, that he says, you know, that it's up to God to decide. He is sovereign and he can decide, I am going to put my name here. You can build an altar. Because he gives him instructions straight after that as to what to do with it, right?
Well, there's a bit of an issue here. Let's finish. There is a scholarly answer for this one.
Mm-hmm.
I will present the scholarly answer, but let's first all continue reading what he does next, and then I'll bring the scholarly answer for this one. So
now it came to pass the same night, this is from verse 25, that the Lord said to him, take your father's young bull, the second bull. Interesting. We don't know what that means, but the second bull.
So calls it par hashor asher le'avicha, the ox bull that your father has, yours says hasheni. Now hasheni usually means the second. I looked at certain commentators and they actually say that hasheni here specifically means this is a fattening cow. This is a cow they fattened. So I saw several commentators say it doesn't mean second, which I find very strange because I've never seen the word second to mean fattening. I find it as being very, very unusual that these commentators said this.
But maybe it's in reference to the size of the bull, like it's twice as big, you know what I mean? Maybe
it can be reference to its size, you know, Hasheni, the second, you know, this big doubled size thing.
Double-sized thing, yeah.
It wears not 1X, it wears 2Xs. I don't know. Let me look at this for a second if there's
you look that up and I'll read on. It says the instructions are the second bull of 7 years old and tear down the altar of Baal that your father has and cut down the Asherah image that is beside it and build an altar to Yehovah your God on top of this rock in the proper arrangement and take the second bull and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the image which you cut down. So Gideon took 10 men from his servants and did as Yehovah said to him, but because he feared his father's household and the men of the city too much to do it by day, he did it by night. So that there it was in the morning, you know, after breakfast, they came out, and lo and behold, it's all over. It's done.
It's gone. Now, by the way, notice the fact that this ox, the second ox, is 7 years old, and that's the exact same time of the enslavement.
Oh, true.
So
that's true.
Ox here is representing this enslavement for Temidian as well. Maybe. I'm saying this as a speculation. He goes and he builds this altar on Rosh HaMaoz, which can be a high place or some kind of safe place that they had there. One of the ideas is, first of all, he's afraid. So, you know, he's afraid of the people, so he's going to do it. You know, he's a messenger of God, but he's basically still afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see basically that one of the ideas I saw about this whole fear thing is that they're basically saying the message here is no matter if you're afraid or not afraid, you're strong or not strong, if God decides to do something, he's going to use whatever he sees, whoever he sees fit to use, and he'll use them and he'll get them there, no matter what difficulties they have.
Amen.
And but you see this element of fear. He's afraid of the people, so he's doing it at night. Now, one of the scholarly answers about the issue of these two of this altar is that the first altar is really also the second altar. And we mentioned this altar called Shalom, but we just mentioned it. Now we're given the account of exactly how this altar was built.
Mm-hmm.
And he does something which is like, you know, blasphemous or whatever it is, sacrilegious to them. He just goes and he just destroys it. The altar probably to Baal, because there's an Asherah next to it, and Baal and Asherah usually come together. And Asherah with either a tree or a wooden pole. Mm-hmm. I think I mentioned this before.
Yes.
And he takes 10 men and they just destroy it, you know, as the story says. You know, and but what you see here, his father kind of like defends him. And he says, if Baal is God, let him fight for himself.
Yeah.
So his father, first of all, his father puts his foot down. His father makes a point. His father owned the altar. But now his father is, you know, he's probably having some kind of remorse of building this altar, whatever it is.
Mm.
And he basically turned around and said, you know, this is a very simple question here. He's coming in the name of our father, the God of our fathers, attacking this altar of Baal. And he says, the God of our fathers, we know from the stories that he really did actions. Mm-hmm. You can just imagine, picture his father standing there. This guy is a farmer, but he's important. You can see he's talking. He opens up his mouth. It's not as if the elders of the village are like, kill him, you know, off with his head. They're all stone him, whatever you want to use. And they go
to his house, and they don't just intrude into his house and take Gideon. I mean, they come and they say, bring him out to us so that we can knock him off. And he said, hey, come on. You know,
he turns around and says, what are you talking about? He says, if Baal is God, let Baal fight his own wars.
Mm. And now there's a couple of parallels with, of course,
Elijah,
because we have the meat, the offering being consumed miraculously, and also the words of his father, which also very much echo that of Elijah. So that's interesting. And the men of the city said to Joash, "Bring out your son," and he said, "No, look, you know, if Baal is God, then you know he can deal with it himself." And so what do they call him? They give him a name.
They give him a name, Yerubal. And the thing with the name Yerubal is really Yerubal actually is something positive towards Baal.
Mm-hmm.
The original name, I saw commentary says that it was actually that name actually meant something about Baal being great. But here they gave him this nickname, which means Yarev Bohabal. He fought the Baal, or something to that extent.
Interesting. I'll tell you what I've got in verse 32 in English. It says, therefore on that day, he called him Yerubal, saying, let Baal plead against him because he has torn down his altar.
Yeah, more or less.
More or less. Then
Yarev Bo, when you look at Yarev Bo, so who's the Bo? So Bo is probably probably referring to Gideon. So let Baal try to fight him for he destroyed his altar. Yeah, I agree with that translation. Okay.
Then all the Midianites and the Amalekites of the people of the east gathered together, and they crossed over and encamped in the valley of Yisrael. But the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew the trumpet. And
it says shofar in Hebrew. He blew a shofar, a trumpet.
Okay. And they all gathered behind him, and he sent messages throughout all Manasseh, and who also gathered behind him, and he sent messengers to Asher and Zebulun and Naphtali.
Asherah.
And they came up to meet him. So now he's gathered the people.
So he's gathering northern tribes again.
Yeah.
In Midian in the south, he's gathering northern tribes. So why are they gathering northern tribes? Because if he's from Ephraim, he's actually relatively in the north. So these are tribes that are closer to him.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to remember, again, the tribes had, they were basically families or tribes that dealt with themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And only the ones which were near them, they actually cared. And there was no unity amongst the tribes. And this is why, for example, when archaeologists say, oh, these were really Canaanites, they weren't Canaanites. There was a problem with unity. So you go around and people kind of did whatever they wanted. So these guys would look like Canaanites, and these guys would look like Philistines, and these guys would look like Egyptians, and these guys would look like Syrians or Assyrians, whatever. That's because there was no unity. There was no dress code. There was nothing.
Sure.
They probably didn't even speak the same dialects of Hebrew, some of them.
Sure. So now, here we are, we're coming up to the fleece ride, and before we talk about that, I just want to come back on something that you said, and that was in regards to, of course, verse 17, that we see he first asked for a sign, and here he is being very cautious. It can be interpreted to say that he's very fearful, and we obviously see that in verse 27, where he takes out the idols at night in fear of his father's household and the men of the city, it can be argued that maybe that was a wise move to do it at night. Because we're probably talking about a high place, right? Would that be fair?
Yeah, it was probably a high place. But when we say high place, it's not necessarily on a mountain somewhere. We have verses, for example, in Ezekiel 18, mm-hmm. where it talks about, you know, he did not eat to the mountains. He didn't turn to the mountains. That's where they sometimes build, you know, altars. But a high place is basically made like a podium, like the word Bama. And Bama in Hebrew, modern
right
Hebrew
in
means a stage.
Probably not right in the middle of the town. I mean, if you're going to make that kind of noise and destroy something like that, they would have woken up and heard about it. But
you have to remember these places excuse me, these places were treated as holy sites.
Mm.
So they actually probably were outside of the village,
mm-hmm.
yeah, not inside.
So they would have found it in the morning. So, but then we see him wanting to test the situation again and just get added confirmation. And it, mm-hmm. and it makes me wonder, because with the example of Moses, Moses keeps saying, I can't do it. And what if they don't believe me? And what if this happens? And are you sure you got the right guy? Because, you know, blah, blah. And he goes on and on. And it seems to be reasonable, because God is saying to him, no, I'll give you this sign, and I'll give you this sign, and I'll give you this sign. And eventually God says, hey, enough of this. You're really starting to tick me off, and I'm going to, it won't work out well. You will be quiet now, and this is just what's going to happen, whether you like it or not.
Exactly.
Here we have Gideon. He asks for a sign. He receives the sign. Here we see he's about to ask for two more signs, and he receives them. He hasn't gone past that point where God says, you're starting to get on my nerves. Be careful. Just do what you're told. It seems that the
actually,
request
God
that
kind of fades, kind of slightly fades out of the story at one point.
Yeah, God kind of does, but it seems to be that the request that he asks is reasonable, and God grants him those requests. And it makes me think, you know, Yoel, a lot of people, at least in the tradition that I come from, a lot of people say, oh, God told me to do this, and I just, you know, go and do it. And I would challenge people to just ask for confirmation. I don't think that it's a bad thing to do. I think it would be wise if more people did that.
So there's a big question regarding this issue of confirmation. Mm-hmm. I always say big question. I don't really always necessarily mean big question or big argument or argument. It's just a type of jargon of speech that I developed throughout the years studying in yeshiva. Mm-hmm. But the basic idea is that we learn from this that you can ask God, you know, to give me a sign of some sort. So, for example, I don't know. I just did something very, very similar. You know, I went to fly to the United States, and mm-hmm. thank God the people contributing to it.
Yes.
And I did something like this. I said, I have a dual citizenship, and I'm also a British citizen, but I've never mm-hmm. really applied for my passport. So I did something like this. I said, you know what? You do this. I'm going to send the passport, and if it's here with no issues, and because of something really silly the Mossad did several years ago, by stealing British identity, so that they've limited the places you can actually apply from. Used to be you can just go to Tel Aviv, put in the files, and 2 weeks later you got it. Mm. Now it's become 4 to 6 weeks. So I said, you know, here's a possibility. So I do this sometimes, and I say, if this works out, I know God is helping and behind it. And I said something very similar. I'm sending it out. There's no issues. There's not going to be any problems. It's going to get there, and it's going to come back quickly. But I know that this flying to the United States is something that God approves of. Because, you know, flying to the United States from Israel is very, very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, every penny is difficult. So
I need to be sure
it's the right thing to do. So that's basically say, you know, if it works out, I know that God wants me to go there. So I left that sign out. I'll keep you updated what's going on.
But so far, as far as that's concerned, it seems to be running smoothly, right?
Well, we actually had a bit of a hiccup in the middle because I sent it and there was no word of it. It was as if the package vanished,
mm-hmm.
and I called up the courier service and I said, you know, where's my package? And he looks up and he calls me back and says to me, oh, it's stuck in customs. So it took instead of 3 days to arrive, it took 4 days to arrive.
Okay, it's a small
thing. That's not bad yet.
Keep us up to date on that. But look, I do exactly the same thing. I do the same thing when something major happens and I think, oh, it looks like I'm going to have to do this or I'm going to have to do that. Then I do ask God and I say, look, would you please give me confirmation in this regard? And I would encourage people to do that because I think it's a very wise thing to do. And so we see here, Gideon.
Yeah, but don't wait for voices to speak with you.
No, not necessarily voices to speak with you.
If you're hearing voices, you should go see a shrink.
So Gideon.
So he does a double-sided request. He takes a piece of wool and he puts it the first time and he says, you know, he put the wool in a goren, in a threshing floor area.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, if there's only water on the goren, on the wool and the land around is dry, then I know it's a sign. So he picks it up, you know, it's full of water. He actually squeezes a cup of water out of it, and the rest of the land around is dry. Then he does the other end of it. He says, you know what? I want a piece of wool being completely dry and everything around it being wet. and he gets it as well.
So there's no question about it. He's got to do it. He's
so stuck. This is already a level. This is already starting to go to the level of miracles. This is not just requesting.
Oh, this is certainly a miracle. I mean, it's not as if. So he says, you know, if the Jew is all around, but it's dry, then I know. And so he does it. And the interesting thing is that the verse 39. Then Gideon said to God, "Don't be angry with me, but you know, and maybe he heard about Moses, you know, and maybe he knows the story well." And he knows
actually, he's speaking very similar to as Abraham when he says,
"That's true." Yeah, please.
There's no 50 people, or maybe 40.
Chapter 18, I think, of Genesis, when he's talking about Sodom and Gomorrah.
Not very good with chapters. I'm usually just know where it is.
and so Gideon said to God, "You know, don't be angry with me, but let me speak just 18. This once more. Let me test, I pray." And so just once more, let's do the opposite. Let's have the Jew on the fleece, but not on the ground. Let let the fleece be dry, but all the ground around be wet. And so that's what God did. And so there it is, unquestionable. So he goes ahead full steam. Now look, Yoel, we could go on. We're now coming into chapter 7, you know, but I think we've run out of time. I think we're going to have to do.
I think that, yeah. I mean, as people have noticed here, we're so many details, and we'll probably have to do a part 2 on this story.
Maybe even a part 3, because we've got chapter 7 and chapter 8, and we will get to that next week, but we're going to call it quits because we've run out of time. My goodness, there is so much in these portions. We're going to have to spread one judge over two Light of the Prophets episodes. So anything to close up on? Any last thoughts?
I don't know if specifically last thoughts, but we basically notice that the Book of Judges is a lot of details at one point. There's actually an entire research that I saw, an entire book called The Book of Judges and the Art of Editing. And there's a lot that goes on in this book. I mean, really, we have after this is a few other major stories, and there aren't too many stories going on in the book, but they span over a lot of chapters because there's a lot going on in each one of them. And for example, the story of Samson is just piles and piles and piles of information as well, and it's really, there's a lot going on. After this we have Avimelech, which is a whole story by itself that gives us a lot of insight about the world that we're in. And then we have Yiftach, which is a whole, as we say, mess by itself. And then we have Shimshon, and I'm just flipping through here, and Shimshon goes it's over several chapters,
with,
and then
jam-packed with action, right? I mean,
then we have Micha, and the story of Micha with his little temple, and then we have this horrible Levite that's causing a little trouble, and who he was, and you know, there's like 21 chapters in this book, but it's like it's more and more and more. Think about when we go into Samuel. I mean, really, Samuel can be like 20, 30 episodes probably. Yeah. There's so much going on there as well. Yeah. So it's basically, we're going to be busy for a while, I think.
We're going to be busy for a while, so looking forward to getting into Chapter 7 and Chapter 8, the last chapters in regards to Gideon. Hopefully we can finish that next week. But we've been speaking with Yoel Ben Shlomo, his Facebook page, by the way, that he made mention of earlier on, Hebrew in Israel. If you go to Facebook and look up Hebrew in Israel, like the page and get involved there with the Levite and Land. And if these programs have been a blessing to you, you can also show your support by donating at truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. Next week, we're going to be starting off from Judges chapter 7. Until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Thank you.